Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We are about to talk about how Americans regard and treat one another. A spokesperson for a Donald Trump super PAC went on the Megyn Kelly show this week on Fox, and Carl Higbee defended a proposal made by one of the members of President-elect Trump's transition team to create a national registry for immigrants coming from Muslim countries. As Higbee explained, there is a precedent for something like this in America.
We've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
You're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am saying is that we need to protect
America.
I mean,
that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it, and I'm not saying I agree with it, but in this case, I absolutely believe that a regional base...
You can't be citing Japanese internment camps as precedent for anything the president-elect is going
to
do.
Look, the president needs to protect America first, and if that means having people that are not protected under our Constitution have some sort of registry so we can understand, until we can identify the true threat and where it's coming from, I support it.
Talk like that alarms Tom Ikeda. He is executive director of Densho, a Seattle organization that preserves the testimonies of Japanese Americans incarcerated in U.S. internment camps during World War II. Tom's grandparents came to Seattle from Japan in the early 1900s. His parents, grandparents, uncles, and aunts were sent to Minidoka, the internment camp in Idaho.
There's one story that I think a lot about, especially during this time. You know, my grandparents, their eldest son, my uncle, was a student at the University of Washington. You know, while he was at the University of Washington, he took ROTC classes. He was smart. He was athletic. And when the war broke out and he was, went with his parents to the Minidoka camp, he still wanted to serve the country. And he volunteered to serve in the Army. And when he took his physical, he actually failed it. There was something wrong with his kidney. And he was so despondent, my grandmother gave him an herbal remedy, and he was then able to pass the physical. And because of my uncle's ROTC training, he was made a staff sergeant in the segregated 442nd Regimental Combat Team, was all Japanese-American infantry unit. And while they were fighting in Europe, he was killed in action by a sniper's bullet. And there's a photograph that I have of my grandparents in the Minidoka concentration camp. It's in a dusty field. And there are hundreds of people at this memorial service where they are accepting the American flag for their eldest son who was killed in action. You know, it makes me angry to this day that they had to accept the flag for this sacrifice in a concentration camp because, you know, our country didn't think that they were loyal enough and they had paid this incredible sacrifice.
What were the citizens of the Puget Sound area saying about those actions back then?
I think that's the crux of the story. You know, as this was happening to their fellow citizens, you know, people remained silent. And it's understandable in the sense that there was this climate of fear and hatred that was going on. You know, the media, politicians were painting Japanese and Japanese Americans as the enemy, as someone to be feared and to be suspicious of. And so in that climate, people remained quiet. You know, they were thinking, well, maybe there's something behind these stories. And even though these people were innocent, they were painted as being dangerous. That's what led to people not speaking up during World War II.
What connection do you see between a registry and physically holding people against their will in camps?
You know, it doesn't happen with just one big step. I mean, in the case of what happened to Japanese Americans, it started off with a lot of negative rhetoric. You know, again, painting them as a suspicious, dangerous community. And then what happened in the, Japanese immigrants, you know, they start registering them, you know, even before the war started. And then after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all families had to register. And then once, you know, those lists are there, then they're more easily rounded up and placed into concentration camps. And so it's part of a process that we've been, you know, watching and, you know, we're alarmed at because, you know, we've seen the negative rhetoric And now they're talking about registering. And so we think it's important that, you know, not only do we bring a historical perspective, but that we speak up that, you know, these are the steps that led to, you know, a mistake back in 1942 that we don't want to happen again.
So when some of Trump's defenders say, look, he just wants to be careful about Muslim immigrants, he's not going to round up innocent people, what do you want to tell those folks?
That's what they said back in 1942, and it led to the incarceration of 120,000 innocent people, two-thirds of them U.S. citizens with no due process, and it's a mistake that we do not want to repeat again.
Tom, what actions are you personally taking?
So we're reaching out to targeted communities. I mean, in particular, the American Muslim community, as well as the African American community. You know, we think that, in particular, those communities right now are being targeted, and it's important for us to reach out, hear their stories, get to know them, and be allies with them, as we wanted to have allies back in 1942 that we didn't have. So it's important that I think all Americans really, you know, get involved, you know, wake up, start reading, get informed, reach out to these communities, get to know them. I think that's the step that we're taking right now.
We didn't mention Latino Americans, other immigrants, undocumented immigrants. What about those communities?
Yeah, exactly. I think we need to reach out to all communities at this point. You know, my hope is that we can use the turmoil that is, you know, happening in our country today to really reach out and get to know each other better. That the politics of fear and division, we have to fight against. And the way I see right now for us to fight against is for us to really reach out and have these conversations. That if we stay on in our own sort of groups and just sort of repeat what we hear, you know, my fear is that our country will be more and more divided. And as we get more and more divided, more and more bad things are going to happen. And so, again, I think right now we have to, in some ways, again, as I said earlier, wake up, get more informed, but to reach out and start talking to people and not just listening to, you know, hateful speech on radios or on blog posts or on social media, but actually talking to people and reaching out and hearing, you know, both the common ground and differences, but having these conversations.
Tom, where would you say you are on the spectrum of fear that history will repeat itself versus hope that this America is not the same America as we had in the 1940s?
You know, just in this past week, you know, I've been on a roller coaster in terms of how I feel about, you know, where this country's going. When I, you know, take a historical perspective, you know, that gives me actually hope that I look at our country and recognize that, you know, we have been in very difficult situations and we've always been able to pull together, that there is a spirit in America that, you know, when things get tough, you know, people do wake up and pull together, even in the face of fear and hatred. And so today I am more optimistic that I'm not saying that it's going to be easy. I'm not saying that you know, bad things won't happen, but I am optimistic longer term that, you know, we will pull out of this and we will pull out of it stronger, because there are so many good people that I've talked with in this last week who really care, that are now pledging to get more involved, and I think that's a good thing.
It's interesting to hear you be optimistic, at least right now, Tom, given that, you know, some, you could also say, well, yeah, the United States dropped nuclear weapons that killed and injured so many, and from that victorious post-World War II point of view, the U.S. had the luxury of looking back and saying, oh, well, I guess that was a mistake, but, you know, it happened all the same and it could have gone differently.
Well, so the important thing for me is that we learn from our mistakes. I mean, you know, thinking about this concept of registering, you know, Muslim immigrants, we know from history that when the United States did similar things, that was a mistake. And we took the time to examine it, to look at it. And, you know, I think back, it was President Reagan in 1988 who signed the Civil Liberties Act. And he apologized. He said this was a mistake that we did to Japanese Americans and that we need to make sure that doesn't happen again. So if we could just pay attention, if we could just remember the mistakes we made in the past so that we don't repeat them, but to move forward in a way that we keep learning. I mean, you know, race relations, you know, back 75 years ago was more difficult. We lived in a segregated South. You know, my uncle had to fight in a segregated infantry unit in the war, you know, all Japanese American. So there was a very different era that we've progressed from. And so I believe that if we keep focused, if we keep opening doors to other opinions and other ideas and keep, you know, talking, the country can learn from. And so that's why I still remain optimistic.
That's Tom McKenna talking with us from Seattle's International District. He is the executive director of a Seattle organization called Densho that tells the stories of Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in internment camps, concentration camps, he called them, during World War II. The place where Japanese Americans were first taken from their homes here is Bainbridge Island. In fact, there's a memorial you can see at the old Bainbridge ferry terminal. And that is where Lily Kadoma told us her story a couple of years ago. She and her family were interned. We are tweeting out a link to our conversation with her at KUOW. And finally, President-elect Trump met today with Japan's prime minister. It was his first meeting with a foreign leader. He's also been taking calls from around the world. He has not, though, asked for any input from the U.S. State Department. We'll tell you more about that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the 5 days after the U.S. election, the Southern Poverty Law Center collected more than 400 reports of intimidation and harassment, the majority involving anti-immigration and anti-black slurs. If you witnessed somebody yelling slurs at someone else, what would you do? This last summer, two Seattleites were sitting in a Starbucks on Capitol Hill, Yoshiko Hardin and Bob Hughes, both college administrators. She's at Seattle Central. He's at Seattle University, both African-American. And something happened. It was loud. It was hostile. It was racist and sexist. And virtually nobody in that Starbucks stepped in to help. I want to warn you before you listen to their story that you might find the language here disturbing.
It was Friday morning. We had a 10 o'clock meeting at Starbucks just to catch up. Bob and I have known each other through the education system for a while, and I'm new to my role at Seattle Central. So he reached out to say, would you like to meet? I hear you're back kind of on the hill and at the college, which is great. So we met. It was about 10:30. We were about a half hour into our meeting, and I felt something warm on my face and my forearms, and I thought that someone had tripped and spilled their drink, their warm drink. And so I looked over and there was a young white male looking at me. And can you swear on radio?
We can try.
Okay. So, and I looked at him and he said, "F-ing nigger bitch." And I kind of stopped. And it was at that point I realized it was spit on my face and hands, that he had spit on me. And then he kind of wound up to do it again. And spit again and got on me again. And for sure, at that point, I saw that it got on Bob and got on his coat. And then he yelled again and just kind of casually walked out. I got up to get some napkins and he stood at the window and was yelling. We couldn't hear him, but assume he was yelling around the same language, same thing.
What did you guess at what was going on in his head? What do you think it was about?
Well, in that moment, I thought he's gonna kill me, is what I thought. And, my professional background, 15 years working in race, ethnicity, justice work, and studied all of these type of scenarios, and have been called all of those names before, but never just someone popped off. You know, usually, like, I cut them off on the freeway, or took their parking spot. So that was what was stunning to me. Many people have said, well, he must be crazy, quote unquote, or he must
That's the first thing that came to mind. If he's yelling for appropriate of absolutely nothing.
Yeah. So I've seen people, I know people in my family, I see people around my job who I think might be mentally ill because they're displaying behaviors, like talking to themselves. And he wasn't displaying any of those behaviors. So my first thought was, do I know him? And then I thought, he's going to kill me.
If you'll remember, it's actually my first question to you. Do you know this guy?
Yes.
After he had walked out, because he's a much smaller man than I am. I wasn't particularly afraid, but I was kind of trying to figure out, where does he come from? And I agree with Yoshiko. I walk up and down James and Pioneer Square every day to get to work. And I've got a pretty good sense of when somebody is mentally unbalanced or displaying those kinds of behaviors. That's not what this was. This was anger. This was hate. This was someone who saw her and decided he was going to unleash his anger and hatred.
How did the people around you react to what had happened?
Well, there was a woman, a white woman, who was down near the till where you order food. And she was the person who said, manager, manager, your customers are being called racial epithets, I think is the language she used. And they're being spit on. And that's how the manager was notified that something was happening in the store table area.
But what struck you both, it sounds like, was how little reaction there was outside of this one woman, this one white woman.
Absolutely. After the incident, we waited at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half for the police. We didn't go anywhere. We were in the same spot. Nobody approached us. Nobody looked at us. Nobody talked to us. It was as if the incident didn't happen.
And this was a mixed race crowd or all white or who was there?
It was a mixed race crowd. So it was very diverse. There were other black people in the Starbucks and there were other black women. There were white people. I mean, it was a regular busy morning, people on their devices, people coming in and out.
And what did it say to you that there was so little reaction?
That it wasn't important. That, you know, something that had really changed my life didn't show up as meaningful or impactful for others besides Bob and the woman who came over. And I think one of the things I said to Bob after it happened is, this is so bizarre. This just happened to us, but yet everyone's life just goes on as if nothing has happened. You know, you can still hear the machines whirring, you know, making milk steaming, like nothing stopped.
And that is bizarre to me. If we had been in a car wreck, would people have just walked by? Would people have stopped and tried to do something? It's been really interesting over the last month or so since the incident, and I posted my blog. I got a significant number of responses of people saying, well, no wonder they didn't respond. No one responded. You didn't respond. Well, I don't expect that anyone would physically intervene in an instant when neither one of us were physically responding. We were shocked by it. But I do expect that people would involve themselves afterward, as this woman did. I mean, the woman who notified the manager made a point of coming up to me and to Yoshiko and saying, look, this should never happen to people, and if you want a witness, I'm here. That seems to be sad to me that only one person did that.
Is what you were hoping for basically what that one woman did?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was hoping for. I mean, some of it's in retrospect, but even the police, when they came, the police officer said, I'm surprised that no citizens intervened. Sometimes people will intervene to hold someone until we get here. So they even noted, like, no one said, stopped, or even said anything to the person, like, get out of here, or, you know, challenged the young man who did this.
I want to ask you, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But I wonder if maybe I'm one of these people, white male in my case, although there were others there, I might have been one of those people who wouldn't have responded. I'm trying to put myself in that space. For one thing, somebody yelled, I'm looking away, I probably didn't see spit. When I hear someone yell, even something like what he yelled at you, I think I probably would have thought there's a fight going on, even though there wasn't, right? It was probably a fight that didn't involve me. I'm not sure what's wanted of me in this situation. I might have kept on looking at my device. And I wonder, since the rest of the crowd isn't here, you can put it on me. Like, what does it say about me? What are you thinking that that says to you?
It says to me that your own personal whatever activity is more important than the community in which you're engaged. That seems to me a mistake. I think you need to look. If you hear something like that, you need to say, what's going on here? Is this something that does concern me? Because frankly, it was. This is a public space in which somebody assaulted two people. And if you allow that to happen as a member of a community, then what do you want from your community? What happens when it happens to you? Do you want somebody to be there to at least pay attention to the fact that you're being assaulted? It seems to me that the action is to ignore. And that's not something that you should do or I should do. You know, if it had been a child being beaten by an adult, would you have paid attention? If it had been somebody taking out some sort of weapon and hurting somebody, would you pay attention? At what level do you start paying attention? And my point is, if we're going to live as part of a community, we need to be aware of those things that happen. And let's say that this was a young man who knew us both and decided he was angry with us and decided to assault us. Well, regardless of that, you have a responsibility to know that that happened. You have a responsibility to not necessarily intervene. Again, I make the point that I don't expect people to intervene. I do expect people to pay attention.
My first reaction was that, man, I don't, a ruckus, something broke out. I don't think I would have said anything. It's not my business. But as you're explaining it so vividly now, I guess, yeah, I hope I would have at least said, are you okay?
I think that's all it takes for a community to act as a community. Something that simple.
Well, what gets us thinking about this is when you draw a connection between being quiet at a Starbucks, you know, in a case like this, a connection between that and a bigger, a silence, a denial, an apathy, you start to hit people where they live, because I don't think most of our listeners, at least most of our white listeners, I'm not sure would make a connection between looking at their device, looking away, and a bigger apathy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can support causes, right? And then it's another thing when it is there in your face. It's a different test, you know?
You know, here's something else, confessions of a white person here. It's awkward to come and say, that man just yelled horrible things at you. You know, I don't stand with that. I'm one of the good white people. It, you know, there's something that feels a little self-congratulating and patronizing about that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that's something
like
white people
you can handle yourself.
I think that's something that, you know, like my white colleagues and friends who support our anti-racism work, that's something that they deal with, is wanting to be supportive but not patronizing, and wanting to participate but not come in as if they're going to run it and own it. That's not how I would have experienced that, but I think that's something that's a fair statement. Right. Do I now approach this, you know, black couple as a white person who just experienced an assault by another white person? And what is that going to mean to them?
Right. So what's the right way to insert in a way that's respectful of you, of everything that's gone on?
What you said earlier, I think, is really a strong statement. Are you okay? Come and ask me if I'm okay. Don't ignore me. Don't look away. Don't pretend that nothing happened when something really did. We have the Seattle nice culture that we talk a lot about and we laugh about it. But underlying that are some really deep truths about who we are as a community in terms of being engaged with people who are different than us. We're more segregated today than we have been as segregated today as we have been in this city's history. I mean, look at our schools. Look at our communities. Who lives where? You know, all of that has significant impacts on how we interact with each other. And if we don't ask questions, if we don't engage, and especially when we see something deeply going wrong, if we don't engage in that, then we're at danger as a community of further segmenting, of further isolating ourselves from each other, and we'll never come to being aware of each other and our needs.
That's so interesting to think of even something as outrageous as that to have been an opportunity to just ask you a question. How are you doing? That stands in for so much, so many opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell people, just say, I don't know what to say, but I feel really uncomfortable. I mean, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to have it all perfect and processed and just, you know what? I don't know what to say in this moment, but I feel really uncomfortable about what I witnessed. And are you all okay? It doesn't need to be perfect.
Yoshiko Hardin and Bob Hughes, both college administrators here in Seattle. Bob's an associate dean at Seattle University. Yoshiko, vice president of student services at Seattle Central. They were spit on and racially insulted at a Seattle coffee shop back in June. And we don't know that this had anything to do with politics. We know that in the 5 days after the election, the Southern Poverty Law Center collected more than 400 reports of intimidation and harassment, mostly involving anti-immigration and anti-black slurs. Well, some KUOW listeners are drawing a connection between bigotry and the presidential election. Julianne writes, "The election of Trump has written a blank check for incidents like the one that happened in that Starbucks. More will follow." We'll see about that. And whether it's election-related or not, many of you have told us online that in the face of intimidation and harassment, Americans should not stay silent. And finally, you've heard so much this week about Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's incoming White House chief strategist who ran the website Breitbart, which he called the platform for the alt-right. The alt-right's been associated with racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, and its adherents say they have a voice in the new Trump administration. So we are going to talk with the white nationalist who coined the term alt-right and let him speak for himself this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The Northwest timber industry has changed so much in the past few decades. In the wake of environmental rules and lawsuits, logging has declined on federal lands. Automation has reduced the number of jobs in the mills and the forests. And the economy and trade deals have not always been favorable to logging. Donald Trump's election victory has communities in the Northwest timber belt cheering and hoping better times are ahead. EarthFix reporter Jess Burns takes us to Oregon's Douglas County, where Trump won with 64% of the vote.
Welcome to Riddle, Oregon, a town of about 1,200 in the heart of timber country.
Riddle is really a close-knit community. We have very little division here.
The town is surrounded by four sawmills. Neighborhoods end where stacks of sprinkler-soaked logs begin. Riddle's chosen leader for the past two decades is Mayor Bill Duckett, who worked in the local mills for more than 30 years. He says the post-election mood is good.
I think the people here in town, Douglas County in southern Oregon, is very happy with the results of what came out. I am happy with the way things went.
And this is the reason.
Timber jobs have been cut in half since 1990. We're going to bring them up, folks. We're going to do it really right. We're going to bring them up, okay?
At a rally last May in Eugene, then-presidential candidate Donald Trump appealed to rural Oregon and an industry he says has been hammered by federal regulation.
I think this is going to open up opportunities. Some things are going to be changing. People were just tired of the same old, same old. People were tired of promises and no results.
It's one of the best smells in the world. Fresh sawn lumber.
The smell of dug fir permeates the cacophonous Swanson Sawmill, about 30 minutes to the south of Riddle in Glendale. This mill and a plywood plant down the road employ about 400 people. Steve Swanson is CEO.
This shift, we have processed 1,470 logs.
Swanson says most of those logs are coming from privately owned timberland. But he'd like that ratio to change, given Glendale is surrounded by federally managed forests.
When you look out here at the landscape, and when you can look around, it's a sea of green. We live in a sea of green.
A Trump administration, with the help of a Republican-controlled Congress, could make steps in this direction, giving his mills an additional supply of lumber. On Swanson's list, changing touchstone environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, loosening logging rules in the Northwest Forest Plan, and passing a law that would increase the cut on Bureau of Land Management lands in Oregon.
But I'm realistic about what a single man can do in the White House. He is not the first Republican president we've had, his heart might be in the right place, but it would take a long time to get the policies that have got us where we are back on track again.
As hopeful as timber communities and the industry are on the eve of a Trump presidency, environmental groups are preparing for a fight.
The logging industry and the lobbyists that represent them they've had their wish list for a long time. It's repealing the Endangered Species Act. It's repealing the Clean Water Act. It's privatizing national forests and public lands.
Steve Pettery is with the conservation group Oregon Wild.
While things might seem pretty dark, and a lot of Americans, I think, are still in shock, we've been through some pretty dark times before. You know, at least speaking for the environmental community and my organization, the plan is not to shrivel up and go away. The plan is to fight harder than we did before.
Still, so soon after the election, and with so little in the way of specific policy details released during Trump's candidacy, it's somewhat unclear what tactics the new administration will take. And even Oregon's only Republican congressman, Greg Walden, is waiting to see where Trump goes.
On timber, I think there are some positive things we can do moving forward. I'm not going to even begin to think I can speak for this new administration. They're trying to get organized and put together, the first rung, the cabinet secretaries, and we'll see what direction they want to go.
And whether that means logging the sea of green, we won't really begin to know until January 20th. I'm Jess Burns reporting from Douglas County.
Meanwhile, construction and concrete firms along the U.S.-Mexico border are crunching the numbers on what it would take to build a 1,000-mile wall. And our Planet Money team will tell you what they've learned this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. The University of Washington Husky football team has seemed so great this season, so roll-up-the-score dominating, that people have been even talking national championship for the team. And then, last weekend, the USC Trojans happened, and the Huskies lost 26-13. So now what? Seattle Times writer Percy Allen, welcome to KUOW.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, what happened against USC?
They lost. Just newsflash.
That's been Percy Allen.
Yes.
See you later.
They lost. Basically, they ran into a team that was just on a roll. They had won 5 straight games. They've turned around their season. You know, that was a USC team that did not start well. They were 1-3 at the start, but they changed their quarterback and they found new life. And they came into Husky Stadium, and it was like the old days, you know, like back in the 80s and 90s, or just even under the Pete Carroll days.
Old days meaning Huskies, Trojans, matter again,
right?
Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, and, just two very good teams, just a lot of talent out there. And Washington, I think, really for the first time this year, was just smacked in the mouth. They were dealing with a lot of speed, and they didn't adjust until very late. They got beat in every fashion, and they know it. And so basically they're just trying to move on from that game.
So moving on, they've got Arizona State this weekend. And first of all, what's the path? Because the college football playoff and bowl game system confuses and frightens me. So can the Huskies still be national champions like people were talking about?
Oh, yeah. So their postseason fate is still in their hands. Basically, if they win out.
Win out meaning every game, they win every game.
Well, and basically every game is 3. So there's 2 left in the regular season. They play this Saturday, Arizona State next week. We all know that one. That's the big Apple Cup.
Yep, you
know,
the Cougars.
In Pullman, that's going to be a really big game. And if they win that game, then they go to the Pac-12 title game. Don't know who they would play there. Maybe Colorado, maybe Utah, maybe even USC, you know, and that would be on a neutral field December 4th, big game there. That would be in Santa Clara. And so if they win that game, basically three games there, then you're talking about a 12-1 Pac-12 champion. I do not see a 12-1 Pac-12 champion being left out of the playoffs scenario. I just don't think that's going to happen.
And then remind me how the Rose Bowl and all the bowls fit into that.
Well, so
that just consolation prize for the teams that don't get in the playoffs?
It really is, which is a strange thing if you're kind of new to all of this, because you know, old folks like us, we've been so ingrained that the Rose Bowl is the end all to be all. Well, this is a new day and age. Basically, we're in the third year of the college football playoff, you know, sort of formula here. And so the Rose Bowl, yeah, it is something of a consolation prize, as weird as that may sound. So Washington right now is looking for something a little bit bigger than the Rose Bowl. If you fall to the Rose Bowl, that's not such a bad place to fall. But for Washington right now, they're thinking about a national championship deal. So if Washington does win out, they would go to the playoffs, and the Rose Bowl would then take the number two Pac-12 team.
By the way, I saw a Seattle Times writer give their odds of making the playoffs at like 32%, according to Nate Silver's 538 blog.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
He's back.
I guess he didn't go out of business. Didn't he miss the field goal in the election?
Well, hey, look. So they are in the sports prognosticating business as well. And so they lay down odds for everything. And you take all of that stuff with a grain of salt. I look at Nate Silver's 538 blog pretty much as I look at the odds in Las Vegas. You know, it's basically, this is kind of what we think, and you can kind of go with us or not.
Or not.
Yeah, we'll see.
Percy Allen of the Seattle Times. Did you just call me old a moment ago, by the way?
Well, I said that we were old. I was putting myself into your boat as well.
And that makes it okay to say that?
Well, yeah, because I know you like that.
Percy Allen, Seattle Times, thanks a lot.
No problem.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. I've been around a long, long time, obviously, according to our last guest. And I know that Seattle's food scene, it's blossomed, it's diversified, it's changed. Restaurants are flourishing. People come from all over the world now to try not just our restaurants, but the natural bounty, the oysters, the berries, Stroll Pike Place Market. How do we get here? The Museum of History and Industry is asking that question in a new exhibit called Edible City. The curator, Rebecca Den, says some of our local food stories will surprise you. For example, did you know Cinnabon is from Seattle? Cinnabon, the cinnamon roll stand at a mall near you.
Cinnabon is so from Seattle because you had this restaurant company, Restaurants Unlimited, Inc. They have all these different restaurants, but it's owned by a couple of people. It's not owned by a huge corporate office somewhere else. And the owners start realizing that shopping malls are becoming places where people want to hang out and maybe get a bite to eat. And they say,
what year was this?
This was, I believe it was 1985, although you should double check me on it. And they say, let's develop a cinnamon roll. We know this fabulous baker in Edmonds. Her name is Geraldine Brousseau. She ran a bakery called Brousseau's, and they called her in to see if she could develop a cinnamon roll recipe for them. So they're big enough that they have a test kitchen on North Lakeway. She goes in and bakes like 2 to 4 batches of cinnamon rolls a day for months. And the Komen family is there tasting them with her, giving advice, trying to develop the right thing. And then Seattle had this spice company, Crescent, which was huge back in the day. And they said, can we come do a cinnamon school and help you figure out exactly the right kind of cinnamon that you might want to use. So they figured that all out. They developed the Cinnabon. They called Geraldine the Cinnamom. And mm-hmm. Yeah, they opened their first store at SeaTac Mall.
Uh-huh, in Federal Way.
Yes, and because the owners are there and hands-on, they're able to make all these little adjustments. Like, oh, the dough is rolled out the wrong way here. Let's change the dimensions. Let's do this. And it it becomes huge. It becomes it goes wild.
But why don't we know that? Why isn't it Seattle's famous Cinnabon?
I don't know how Seattle kind of got lost in that. Maybe that's why we have an inferiority complex. If you're in Philadelphia, you've got your cheesesteaks. And if you're in Maine, you've got your lobster rolls. And then you come to Seattle and sort of what is our food here?
The listener's yelling salmon at you right now.
Yes, there is salmon. And yet you take someone around town and you don't have a salmon sandwich. Maybe you've got a $50 fillet of Copper River salmon for a week in the right season. But you don't have a dish, I think, that you point to.
Right. That's more of a food of the people.
Yes, exactly. And I think lately people have sort of come to realize that we're kind of defined by the ingredients around us in general, by the things that are a product of our geography. And salmon's one of them. But you have shellfish in general. You have berries. You have all of the fruits and vegetables that grow naturally here. And then you have the foods that were brought in by the different groups of people that have come to the city and kind of come to define it. You have teriyaki and you have pho. And I think when you live here, you don't always realize that not everybody has these foods, that not everyone can walk down the street and be picking blackberries as they walk by. And you can't choose between 20 different pho places because it's just not the corner thing everywhere.
Yes, yeah, so you put together this historical tour of Seattle food. And what's the story you're telling with your show?
We're trying to tell people, what is a Seattle food and how did we get here? And there's this long, long history in the city of, you see some themes sort of repeating, where you have, I think in the modern day, like you look at Renee Erickson's oyster bars. And I remember her saying, when she first opened the Morris and the Carpenter, why don't we have a kind of casualish place here where someone can just go and get a dozen oysters and walk in and walk out? And I thought, yeah, why don't we? And then researching the exhibit, you're looking at oyster bar menus from the 1890s.
Right.
And they look almost just the same. Hey, walk in and wow, we have our famous, you know, specific Olympia oysters only here. These things sort of have been here.
The price has changed a little.
The price has definitely changed. The funny thing is that Seattle has always had such an inferiority complex, I think, about itself. And even that stretches back because you have these advertisements for our Olympia oysters, and they say in big letters near the top, in California, sometimes wrongly called California oysters. And it's like, oh, dear Seattle. You know, even way back then, you had to defend yourself.
Why do you think we've had an inferiority complex?
I think we always felt like we weren't big enough. We weren't shiny enough. And that's something that's maybe been changing this last 10, 20 years or so, that we are big and we are shiny. And with food, we do have a place on the national scene, maybe for the first time in our history. And yet, one thing I think I really found through the exhibit was that not being huge is sort of what made us what we are and what helped make us special.
How's that?
Well, you had all these things happen here that couldn't have happened if we were enormous. There's Urban Spoon.
It's an early food app, like a restaurant search.
Exactly. App. And you had these guys here saying, if we were in New York, we would have been crushed. We were just three guys who had an idea. And in Seattle, everyone was friendly. Everyone supported us and helped us and tried us out. And yet it was big enough, you had enough restaurants, that we could actually try this out and make it work. And too small wouldn't have worked. In New York or San Francisco, you couldn't have done it. But Seattle was just right.
And but didn't the Urban Spoon come and go?
Well, they were bought out by a large company. And I would rather that they were still here doing their thing than that they were owned by a giant international corporation. But they did something great, and they did it here, and they couldn't have done it other places.
Do you? By the way, you bring up tech. We're a tech city now. Does that show up on our tables or in our food world?
I think it really does. And the sort of interesting question for me was, why do all these tech people go into food? And one of the answers we got from All Recipes, which is the on and off the world's largest food site,
yeah.
One of their executives said, well, we love to eat. But I think what you've always seen, and this is true even back with other kinds of technology, like when you've had Boeing workers looking for other careers or when the Boeing bus laid off and needing something else to do, people have always turned to food because everyone needs to eat. There's always some kind of jobs that can be found there. And I think something about the mind of someone who is good at technology in a lot of ways is well suited to things in the food business. Like you have Armandino Batali was a Boeing engineer for like 30 years or something. And when he retires, then he starts up Salumi, this wonderful, famous cured meats company. To do Salumi properly, you need to be at least half a scientist. It's something that you need that particular kind of brain to do. And I feel like if he hadn't been an engineer, I don't know that he would have been so great at making cured meat. Something about Seattle is that people tend to stay here. And we're a beautiful place to live. There's a lot to love about it. Even when times get hard, people have not wanted to leave. And so you see these large projects drawing people in, and then people tend to stay and start up their own things.
So what do you want your viewer at this Mohai exhibit to come away thinking differently about the food of Seattle?
I guess I want them to realize how much our geography here and the people who live here and how that changes over time affect the food that we eat. I hope they realize that we actually do have Seattle foods and we do have a Seattle way of eating, and that at this point you could look at a plate or you could walk through an area and say this is the Northwest. This is a kind of Seattle food and maybe even a kind of Seattle person who eats it.
So you said we started by saying that there's not that identifiable Seattle food of the people. You have Copper River salmon or whatever, but that's different. So if I asked you, what's a Seattle food of the people, what comes to your mind now?
What mostly comes to my mind after all of this research is that it is a food that mixes the natural world with all kinds of different cultures. Who those cultures are has changed over the decades.
Because we're a very fertile place and we're also facing westward, facing
Asia. Yes, we have easy access to other areas. We've always been a place that people want to come. So 100 years ago, that might have been all of the Italian families who lived here. It might have been the Japanese American farmers. It might have been the Scandinavian settlers.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you go on through the years, well, suddenly you have Chinese residents coming in the 1970s. And whoa, you're seeing a difference even in the vegetables at Pike Place Market or the flowers that pop up there. You're seeing different kinds of restaurants. The city's first Ethiopian restaurant, I think, was in the 1970s. And that was from University of Washington students who wanted a taste of home. And the fact that we have schools here, that we have businesses that attract here, that we are, I think, a welcoming area for all different kinds of people really affects the foods that we eat. And they keep changing as the city keeps changing.
Rebecca Den's exhibit opens this Saturday at Mohai, Museum of History and Industry, South End of Lake Union. It's called Edible City, A Delicious Journey. And speaking of food, you might be about to have a Thanksgiving meal with somebody who backed your least favorite presidential candidate. I have an idea. Come to KUOW and hash it out on the radio. You and that family member on the radio, not live radio, will record your familial encounter. It might be healing. Send us an email. You can do this. Email us record@kuow.org. record@kuow.org. And you want to have lunch with us tomorrow? Because Sherman Alexie's coming. Chris Vance, Sydney Brownstone, our Week in Review panel shows up every Friday at noon, and we learn from the week's events. We smile. We graciously take issue with each other. Week in Review tomorrow at noon. Hope you can join us.